Good. Me too. Be great.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Well, yes, you're new to us. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks. Well, am I in the right place?
You're in the right place. Well, have you introduced yourself here in a moment?
Okay.
We had a some technical, even in the most sophisticated offices, you get technical difficulties.
Yeah.
Hi, Scott. Scott, are you in the city?
Yeah, I am.
Maybe we can think up, if not today, I'm back here on Thursday.
Okay.
Theo?
I'm here all week, and then I'm here part of next week.
Okay, great. Jonathan Pirelli, I know you have to leave, so do you want to kick off while we're getting things sorted here? Just tell people, share again what's happening with Distilled Intelligence, because you're now, I don't want to steal your thunder, but you've got some big names coming. There's the who and the when and the why.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it. Hello, everyone. Good morning. So this is what the website looks like. If you go to distilledintelligence.com, it's playful, fun, a little bit of retro. We've got a startup summit. We think of it as like Davos for startups. The goal is to bring together founders, funders, and operators. We plan on having about 500 people. Our first announced speakers are Steve Case and Brad Feld. So Steve Case, as many of you know, was the founder of AOL, and which was housed here in Loudoun County, Virginia, which is where most of the data centers in the world are. So Steve will be coming back home for that. Brad Feld founded Techstars and Foundry. A bunch of other speakers will be announced, and we're actually seeking female tech and venture speakers. We are not going to have an imbalance of speakers. About $1 million prize. That's our second day, and we're breaking everyone out into forums where they will hopefully connect and really vibe on the areas that they're interested in, whether it's by vertical or stage of funding. So 2.5 days, October 14th, 15th, ending on the 16th at Lansdowne Resort in Virginia, distilledintelligence.com. I'll throw it in the chat. If anyone has any questions, let me know. We'd love to have you guys present.
Yeah, please. I'll be there. We're bringing some others there, and Jonathan is the second time.
Sure.
You think it's our first Zoom, but it's our 200-something. So yeah, we'll have a good 361 crew there. How many people do you think will be there in total, Jonathan?
Well, we break fire code at 700, so I hope it stays between like 5 and 550 or 600. We've sold out of all of our previous four events, so I'm confident that will happen. But great startups, 100 startups pitching for $1 million and 50 pitching for $1 million, 50 just working to raise.
What does first prize get?
It depends how the judges want to break it out, honestly. It's our money from our fund. It'll probably be 500, 300, 200 is my guess.
All right. We're betting on you anyways. Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
Yep. So thank you, John. So there is a 361 discount code as well you may want to share, or I can share. Okay. So there's a lot to talk about today, but we have some new people. If you're new, come on screen. I know Michael, you're just on. Ella, I see as well. But just quick 30 seconds, if you don't mind, who you are. We like to ask where you were born and where you live.
Hi. Yes, I'm Ella Huang, and I'm an analyst for Bridgepoint Capital. I work for Mark Young, and I'm originally from Houston, Texas, and I'm currently in New York.
Well done. Yeah, say hi to Mark. Michael?
Yes, hi. I'm a New York City boy, born and raised. I live in East Hampton, in the Hamptons now. Essentially a merchant banker working with family offices, one in particular that's a big pipe investor. But really I'm a writer in sheep's clothing. I'm a novelist, short story screenwriter, full-blown journalist, blogger, you name it. You know, I've kind of done it. So I'm not really a financial person like a lot of you. I'm an imposter, but it's great to be here.
You're an imposter, actually. You know, is transparent, for transparent imposter. That's good.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyone else new? Okay, we've got the, there's some people who've moved around, like you, Austin. Like, what are you focused on now?
Yeah, I have actually. So May 27, I stopped working at Google. I achieved my financial independence, so now I can focus on philanthropy and growing my business. At the moment, those are my laser focuses. So Opportunity International is my chosen charity, focused on extreme poverty. They're in 30 countries, 20 million clients, and banging the drum, helping people connect with that mission is mostly what I do these days.
Great. Love that organization.
So yeah, anyone who has ever wanted to have an impact on industry poverty, I'll put my email in the chat. Let's chat.
There you go. And I don't know who iPhone YCF is, HP. If you don't identify, I have to kick you out. Give me a minute. Jason Sidney, you're somewhat new to the overall crowd.
Yes, sir. Let's see. Can you hear me, Mark?
Yep.
Okay.
Guys in Texas are so polite.
Yeah.
I'm not a sir from small town Ohio.
Just how I was born and bred, I guess. But here in Austin, for those that I didn't meet, I work with Parth and his family office, and we have a project where we're offshoring family offices, capital into a few different alternative strategies into the U.S. So we've worked really hard on setting up a vehicle to move money offshore in aggregate amounts bigger than what you could have done traditionally. Foundation-wise, I work with Child Protective Services in Austin. I'm on the Donors Relations Board, and I'm joining the overall board in the beginning of the year.
Good for you. All right. Anyone else? Otherwise, we have a lot to talk about. And Michael, you want to say something?
So I'm not new, but I just wanted to point out, because of the earlier mention by Jonathan about his event, Ohio VC Fest is in September in Cleveland for folks interested in that. And for the folks interested in agriculture, Farm Science Review is also in September in London, Ohio. I'm planning on being at both events. If anyone's interested, reach out. I'll drop a link in the chat.
Sounds good. Your internet's not the best, but if you could drop those links, let's do it. Anyone else? You're buying me time. Just, I'm about to show you something, but anyone else before I need 30 more seconds, so someone step in. Or not?
I can pretend to be new.
Yeah, go for it.
Hey, great to see all of you in Newport, the ones that we saw. We probably saw too much of Giovanni in the pool. But besides that, all was pretty good, especially the West Coast people. It was amazing meeting a few of you guys since I couldn't make it out to the West Coast.
Did a great job there. I would have done it differently, but you did a great job.
How would you have done it? Tell me how you would have done it. I can do it again.
I wouldn't have called out Giovanni. All right, here we go.
I wouldn't have called out Giovanni? Oh, come on. Giovanni and I go back a long time.
All right, let's start this again here. I think it's my first Zoom.
Well, tell us about your sunset. Where did you take the last one?
Well, sunsets happen every day, and so the last ones I did was actually in Newport, and I love sunsets and sunrises because they're never the same. I just really enjoy that time being on my own.
Next time we're in the same space, we'll have to exchange sunset and sunrise pictures. I do the same.
Absolutely. I'm ready to roll. Sorry about that. All right. So big picture. So today I do want to talk about the Hamptons. We'll get that in a second. We have a little bit far with our friend Stephen Burke. He's number 277. He asks us a rhetorical question, it seems, but we will see where he goes with that one. At 11:30, we talk about AI, and we go deeper a little bit on what we're doing with 361 Digital. And then Dr. Ed Yardini, let's by a show of hands, I can do this. We don't need this per se. I'm going to do give me a second. Let's go gallery. By show of hands, who does not know who is Edward Yardini? Carl. Depender. Okay. Do you have my...
But I'm signed up to listen to him.
Okay. Good. So if you come here, you can see it here. We can talk about it here. But at 1 o'clock, he is, he's often on Bloomberg. He's one of the preeminent, voices on Wall Street and has been. He coined the term bond vigilantes in the 80s. He's been on our Zooms a couple times, our events. Do you want to say a few words?
Yeah, he's back in August of 2020. He published a piece that suggested that we're going to have the roaring 2020s, similar to what we had the roaring 1920s, where innovation was going to drive the markets forward. Back then it was autos and the industrialization that went on with Ford. Today it's the tech that we're all chasing. And he called back then for the S&P to hit 10,000 by 2030. And he's going to update his views on that now. And it appears to be all on track. So I think back then it was I think we're selling for around 5,000 on the S&P when he made that call.
Yeah. So that starts at 1 to 1:45.
It'll be one for Ed's going to talk for about a half hour and then take questions for about 20 minutes.
Yep.
So a half hour. So
if you can see the screen, then Thursday will be a little different format for those who are investors or our clients. We're kicking off, instead of generic roundtables, there'll be thematic ones. There'll be three on Thursday. And the way we're doing this is no sell side in the room. It's all buy side. Those who are investing in private credit, real estate, consumer, you'll see later, energy, transport, industrials. Next week, we have healthcare, and a few other verticals. And usually after those verticals, we will have some sell side clients. So we're doing consumer retail. So Lucid and The Wires, which is involved in the fashion and pets industries. And after transport and energy, industrials, ProChem, which has the lower temp paralysis, thyrocycling, and Apollo, and hard tech. So those same kind of things, but it's more on our buy side, and that they'll all be using our 361 from Digital, and you'll hear all about this soon, but I'm going to come back to that when Yasmin is here. Let's talk about the next major event. For us, at least, is in the Hamptons. Oh, I should say. So we say 10th and 12th, 10th, 11th, 12th. So ours is on the 12th. And it's at Topping Rose in Bridgehampton. And it will I'll coincide with a briefing at 11, a meetup. There'll be an allocator lunch, and then a 1:30 to the end of the day conference. But we are changing. This will change a little bit. We're going to put more of an AI slants into it. We're putting philanthropy earlier, and I like the way people are introducing themselves and noting their philanthropy. That might be it's a good tradition. I might twist that. So that, and then the breakouts will happen before we end. I find that it's hit or miss on those breakouts at the end. So it's an important feature, so we want to do those in the middle. And then we'll have AI and industries and at town hall and attempt to do breakouts, but then they'll be, you're in the Hamptons, so it might be tougher to get everybody. It's like Newport and the Hamptons have a certain vibe, which is harder to get you into these breakouts. So that said, you know, a lot of people heading out there that we basically just started. Just being very honest, we are so focused on some other things and what you're going to hear later today. But it's already filling up, and that's in part because there's another event that we're partnered up with, partner Small P, which is the 1640 event, which is on the 11th. There's a reception on the 10th. Their event in Southampton, and you can see the preliminary agenda here. You know, the I'll put this in the chat. I think they'll let me. I'm recording this, so they're gonna slap me, or they're gonna cut this off of the recording, maybe. They want me to bring in families and sponsors, so I'm trying to be helpful. I think they got, you know, the former president, Vice President Pence will be there. Former Republican National Committee Chair, Primus is there. On philanthropy, you know, it's interesting. Steve's moderating a panel on basically addiction and mental health, which I'm very interested in. Some interesting on people on the investing side.
Is this the day before or the day after?
The day before. The day before. And from the Page family, you know, John's going to Bronfman family as well. And then Candace Beaumont is moderating a panel with Scaramucci and others. Okay. You'll see Robert Smith. So
Mark, can we just sign up for that? Or is there a what's the deal?
There's a chart. It's so 100 million and higher. And there's a committee process to get in there. And that will be, and I can help you move that along. Otherwise it's, 3,500 and even that has a committee process, or you can be a sponsor. And they are 10,000 up to 50,000. So there's still, you can still get onto a panel. You can have your own slot. You pay 25K and on mod. So, it's a great group, the day before our events. They make their own judgments on this stuff, but you know, they trust us to feed them, the kind of people they want to see. So if you're interested, ping me. I can help usher that process. I was talking to them last night. I'll talk to them again tonight. And then otherwise, if you want to be involved on one of our panels, it's basically what we always do, but we're going to put, we're going to change something around. I'm not sure what we want to highlight, more AI, but everything's going to be, as Yasmin says, powered by AI. And that sort of takes me, another thing I want to show you, which on our AI side, we have a room, like if you're not a QP or a member, you can't get to all the rooms, but a few rooms we'll always make available, one of which are these briefings. So, for example, we have the Newport Conference. And so all of the transcripts, all of the and the videos and everything, it's on our YouTube channel, but it's not as easy to navigate there. So everything is here. Let me see last week's briefing, for example.
Gentleman was so I made time, and then I was
don't know who's
like,
speaking.
Everything was produced. Next day, and I said, "Listen, I'm free Monday to next week. I have nothing been set in stone."
MJ.
4 day period, and I was just. He was like.
Maybe you're not aware that you're. That was you, MJ. Speak. Be careful. So, like any deal, now here we have a briefing. It will summarize, gives you an info memo. So this is not built to synthesize a briefing just yet, but you can see who said what. Some of the speakers may not have been identified in this particular Did you put the right transcript, Nadav, with the speaker? Okay. No, not from Otter. It's from we have every event. We have now looked at, we have 1,500 events, 1,500 videos, 700 podcasts, and all of them we have Otter, and most of them, let's say half of the voices have been, you can know who's there with us having to do anything manual. Do you have the video for this one? Oh. I don't see it here. I can go to another one. Take, for example, last week. But this will just, you know, where we're moving is to make more sense, just more order from the all the unstructured data that we have. This looks actually, I don't even know what this briefing is, but you can usually see, like, every one of them will basically make your life easier. And let you know who's done what. So that's Jonathan. It was June 3rd. And you can see usually you can see the videos, but I'm not. Again, this is not built for deal. But it is being built. You'll see there are rooms by climate tech and healthcare. I'm not going to open those here because those are deals and not everybody here is a qualified purchaser, but we will be debuting this over the next 2 weeks. Wait for Yasmin to be part of that. And otherwise, you can see all the recordings from Newport. Beautiful venue. And, you know, from Parth to Andrew, and they're all listed in the digest. I will put that in the chat. And a lot of AI focus, so you can see what we talked about, what the AI panel talked about, and the future of AI. And then we talked about industries, Zeitgeist panel. You and Barb seem to see the world. She was on CNBC like 2 times a day, every day. Like, they, you know. But do you guys disagree with on anything?
No. I think we both are focused on the growth side. I was actually in the Zeitgeist just talking about the more secular issues that were concerning to me, because I knew she was going to cover the AI as the driver for the positive side. So, like, we just were kind of yin and yang. That sounds.
So a lot of content, obviously, from last week, philanthropy, but I'll and then just. Big picture, we already seen this stuff. London's net right on the corner on the 18th, 19th of September. We're trying to slip in LA, San Diego. Stay tuned. All this onboarding is going to change, but it's going to be conversational. That's the amazing thing. Just like Grok or ChatGPT, you know, everything's going to be conversational, and which just plays into what we do. I think next is Singapore, Mumbai, New York. So basically the 20th of October, New York, 20th of November, New York, although we have it 18, 19. That'll be our flagship. We can have 250 people at Grant Thornton's offices. We'll do New York twice and Riyadh twice to end the year. And I'll pull back. And we'll talk about AI in a moment. So Lubna, go for it.
Yeah, going back to the schedule in September.
Okay.
The UN Assembly, you know, that whole month of September, you know, like it really starts, I think, on the 7th. But towards the end of September, there'll be the Climate Week and other activities that are the UN General Assembly. So there'll be a lot of people here from all over the world. And I would love to have us to host a 360, an impromptu inject one during that time, and I can.
Yeah, I love it.
So when we speak, I'll discuss that some more, and I'd like to offer I also happen to be the chair of the U.S. chapter for Catalyst now. Catalyst was started back in 2020 by the Schwab and Ashoka, the Schwab Foundation, Ashoka, and a few others to advance the sustainable development goals through social. We can pick a date in here that we can inject between England and.
You heard earlier, many of you, at the Distilled Intelligence Conference. That's October 13, 16. I put that in this schedule. We'll move it to the others. In fact, I think with our new platform, we now have a tech team. We can keep all this in one place, which would be nice.
Hey, yeah,
Yes, dependent.
When you're in Mumbai, India is too long a place to just go for a day or two. And I think maybe we should do after that 7th and 8th in Delhi. I can help you get people there.
Okay. You may be in charge. You may be in charge because I have a family. I have to come home. So you can lead the charge in the Delhi. We're in Singapore and then Mumbai.
Oh, you have to be there. Otherwise, it's not happening.
We got to get over that, but we'll get there. Walter, are you on? Yeah, Walter's got his hand up, in fact. That's your perfect case in point.
Yeah, no, so I just wanted to give everybody a quick heads up that if you're going to go to the London event, think through logistics carefully. Donald Trump's going to be in town from the 17th to the 19th of September.
Which means his entourage is there.
Precisely.
You'd have to charge him quadruple or something, or like 100x or something to attend the 360.
I mean, we were just talking about how Europe, I don't know who's on from Europe. I know it was a bigger deal, it was more than trade. I probably don't want to cut aside. That was interesting. But at least we have clarity on 40% of the global economy. And anyone else for the good and welfare? Or anyone new?
Happy to help you with London. My company is.
Let's talk later today. Mandy or Fabian, anyone but just want to introduce or reintroduce themselves? Jose?
Good morning.
Good morning. Just quick 15 seconds, who you are, if you don't mind, is that for everybody?
Sure. Jose Kreidler. I'm with Curso Capital and also have family office, smaller family office that we specialize in short-term rentals, mostly in the Florida area. On the other side, we actually have in the investment banking practice with a focus on mezzanine financings.
Well, we do fee sharing agreements across 8 banks right now, so happy to do a fee share with you on show you deals that need mezzanine or it'd be an extension of your syndication.
Absolutely. Let's put something together.
We have a webpage for all of this called 361firm.com/bankers. It has all the templates and the principles there.
Excellent. Yeah. I'll take a look at it. Templates, right? Bankers.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And if anyone wants to become a banker, we can help you do that too. You probably came to this call not thinking that you'd become a banker, but I'm here to tell you it's not that hard and it's a lot easier. And if you're not a banker, if you're not registered and you take a fee, you can blow up your deals.
Oh, no, I've had a...
Jose, that's not for you. This is for the rest of the crowd. You get it. It's much easier for me to work with Jose's of the world than people that are just introducing their friends. So,
Hey, Mark.
Yes.
Where is the link? You're talking about becoming an investment banker?
Yeah, you know, again, it's part-time. It's sort of like when you need it. If you want to take a fee, you have to have a license, registered rep license, and I can, and we have a way of tucking you in. So I'll share that link.
Thank you.
And even people who work with family offices or family office principals, that's our family office. We stumbled into this because we're doing a deal with a major fund, and the major fund, Carlisle, they had a broker dealer. Guess who they had it with? Trump Securities, no relationship. They've rebranded. I think it's INTE now. And I was part of their broker dealer, and that's how I relicensed. All right, 1102, unless there's anyone else that's new that wants to introduce themselves, which I welcome. Taylor Finch, I was talking about you yesterday. I just can't stop. I always remember, you know, son of a bench.
Good.
I just can't get that out of my head. I hope to see you in the Hamptons.
Yeah. Planning on it.
Excellent. Anyone else? Well, don't be shy. Okay. I'll 277, I think it is, if I remember it right. Yes. Hardly seems like it. So usually on days like this, 5-6 years ago, you had piles of newspapers, like Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal. Now you have a different, you have a more of an electronic distribution.
I much prefer reading the newspaper. Having it in my hand. So yeah, I do miss it. So we do have a call at one, as Mark mentioned, with Ed Yardeni. When he came with his, Roaring 2020s, I was actually wrong. It was the S&P back in August of 2020 was around 3,400. So he was calling for 10,000 at the end of the decade, and we're on track for that now. So it'll be interesting discussion, and Ed he's a pretty optimistic guy, but I think he's one of the more realistic guys around, and I think this will be a quite an enjoyable 30 minutes of Ed presenting and then taking questions from the group, so feel free to join. Mm-hmm. So the question for today, and this is, came up last week at the in Newport, was really about how is the U.S. going to fund their debt, and are we still going to be able to attract capital given the heavy-handedness that we've treated our allies with, as well as our adversaries, the tariff turmoil that we're causing and all that. There's a lot of questions on what's it going to do to capital. So the short answer from my view is, yes, it is still a magnet. I'm going to show you why. I would also just say that the environment we've been in this year has been really a difficult one to figure out because there's so many inconsistencies with how the administration is implementing policies, how they're describing the policies, how people are reacting to them, how the policies are being reported in the news, that it's actually creating distortions that I think are really throwing people out of whack. You add to that the divisiveness that politics around the world, but particularly in the U.S., is causing, I think is making it difficult for people to see straight. So what I would say to everyone on the call is look past the headlines. Don't focus on data points. Focus on the trend lines and play the administration the way China's doing it, which is don't overreact to any of the announcements. Be patient because some of this is negotiating. Some of the comments are so unusual that they're designed to create an extreme negotiating position that people are getting sucked into. So look beyond the data, and when you look beyond it, you're going to be surprised is what I would say. So just be careful not getting sucked into the headlines. So at the start of the year, there were a couple big issues. One is, are we going to have a recession? We've had that at the beginning of the year for the last several years. This has been the most anticipated recession that will eventually come but hasn't come yet. The second one is, will foreigners stop buying treasuries? And we have not seen that yet. Will they push up yields to demand higher maturities? We haven't seen that quite yet. But I also don't think that the president will get his wish to see rates on the short end going down to 1% anytime soon. I think the drama around the Fed's independence is a sideshow that has not helped the president's desire to have lower rates. I think it pushes rates up. And I think that you'll hear this week the Powell is not moving. The numbers, the odds mark, are 2.1% according to the CME Fed futures for a rate cut this period. It jumps to 57% in September. So the market's really not expecting big moves on rates. They do think rates will come down next year as the Fed leadership might change. The other big question is the dollar weakness a sign of a massive move away from the dollar or not? And I think when you look back at the chart, I would suggest that part of the dollar weakness is really a reversion from the excessive weakness that the euro was experiencing from 2012 forward, really when Brexit and the great financial crisis issues really hit Europe in 2011 and 2012, and you start to see Brexit and the policies put in place is really where you started to see the divide between the U.S. dollar and the euro. And now that you're starting to see some freeing up of the debt break in Europe with Germany really moving more aggressively to spend on defense as well as infrastructure, you've seen the euro strengthen and the dollar weaken. And now you're starting to see that started it back in April. And back at the time, I was a little skeptical that they would be able to follow through with this and have the continuation of executing on their plans because of politics getting in the way. We're starting to see a little bit of that right now in Germany, but we have to see how this plays out. But I think it's going to be harder for Europe to execute and get the full benefits of that, which, Mark, I think goes to part of the reason why Europe agreed to the trade deals so far with the U.S. I also think the U.S. isn't getting the deals that everyone is thinking, but I think it's a sign of money flowing in anyway. So stepping back, because this has been a big issue for a couple of years of the money flowing away from the U.S. So I went into the U.S. Treasury Department's report on the foreign holdings, and if you go back to 23 of the June report, we're at 25.7 trillion dollars of foreign securities held. That's equities and long-term debt as well as short-term debt. You can see most of it's in equities. The majority is in equities with a lot in long-term debt. But in a year, that's moved up by over $5 trillion. So the idea that capital's flowing out and all the worries of the Trump administration haven't come to bear just yet, or weren't able to come to bear then, that was still the Biden administration. But you saw a big increase under the Biden administration before the election. The election comes. These are the top holders of foreign treasuries, foreign holders of treasuries today. The UK and Cayman are listed as two of the top five. They're really custody countries, so that's where a lot of the hedge funds are housed. So that's a little bit of a misleading number. But China has actually pulled back. They are now at a level that I think is among the lowest they've had. They were at 1.3 trillion for most of 2012 to 2016 and have steadily been coming down. But interestingly, you see Canada elbows up. I'll tell you in a minute, they're not really elbowing up as you would think.
Is there an EU aggregate number? Do you know?
I'd have to do the countries rolled up, and I didn't have the time for that. But it is in the report. You can get all the countries in the tick report.
Okay.
And it shows you for each country what the changes have occurred. So just in summary, in the month of May, foreign holdings of treasuries jumped over $9 trillion. That is a record level for the U.S. in foreign holdings. So you would think at this time, with all the drama going on, it would be going down, and it went up. I think this is a sign of the U.S. as a safe haven in times of turmoil really being reinforced. I think it's also a reinforcement of the dollar's role as the reserve currency. You saw buying in May was the highest it's been since August of 22. By the way, the $9 trillion, the increase to hit that level, a 12-month period, treasuries are up over 11.2% in foreign holdings. So it's going the opposite way of what everything that's being reported in the last year. I mentioned China's holdings continue to come down. The high was in 2016 last time. Canada reversed their, went from being big sellers to big buyers. And this is the gyrations that we're seeing around trade negotiations, which is why I'm saying don't get swept up in the short-termism and the headlines. Step back and look at the reality, because over the last 12 months, foreigners have added almost $1.8 trillion to the U.S. And the other thing that I'm going to show you in a minute is you have to separate official, what the governments are doing, from what all investors are doing, the private sector is doing as well. So this is a look at, in the last 12 months, what private investors, foreign investors have added to the U.S. in their allocations. It's a big move up from the lows last May or last April to where we are today. So significant inflows. Not what the headlines are telling you, not what the press is telling you, and not what a lot of the discussions we have on these calls are about. So I think we have to step back and not get us swept up in the emotions. The red line here is showing you what private investments are. The blue line is the official. And as you can see, we're still waiting for the Great Recession. We did have one in May in the second quarter of 2020. That was one of the most shorter-lived recessions in history, but you get a sense that everything's not what it appears, and you're going to hear that again if you join the call with Ed Yardeni later today. So really unusual environment we're in. I think there are a lot of distortions in how trade activity is being conducted, mainly because governments and the private sector are trying to get ahead of the trade issues. So you saw back in the first quarter, big pull forward of imports from the U.S., a slowdown in the second quarter, and then even on rare earths, you saw the window open up with China for rare earths, and boom, we had massive buying of rare earths for a short period. That's the distortions that are going on, and I think it's really screwing people's strategies.
Keep interrupting, but we have the oil reserve. Do we have a rare earth reserve?
No, we don't.
Wow.
Because we didn't think about doing that before we cut off China.
Are we quietly doing that?
I think while the U.S. just made an investment into NP materials that is basically giving them an output agreement, which is what these companies need if they want to be able to be funded into the future. So
yeah,
we are starting to do some of that stuff, but not enough and not planned well enough out. And I don't think, I think this is going to be an issue for the West. The U.S. and Europe have to think about this differently as well. So I think that's one thing. I think one of the struggles for the markets and for policymakers right now is this two-sided issue of inflation, where you have massive deflationary pressures coming out of China, as we talked about the last couple of weeks with their manufacturing overcapacity overwhelming the global system right now. And then you have tariffs on the other side raising inflation or cost of living concerns. And there's a big discussion on tariffs from the administration, or tariffs are a one-time increase. They are if they're done one time. The problem with our tariff policies right now is we haven't gotten to the end of them yet. We're hoping that we get to whatever 15 or 16% tariff levels, and that's it. And then you have the cost of living and inflation adjustment that's done. But when you're in a period like we're in right now, where you keep raising them and re-raising them and cutting them and raising them again, you don't get that. You get constant inflation tick-ups, not the one-time reset. I think that's a real issue. The other thing is there's a bigger view now that tariffs are just a tax, and who's going to get by the tax, and what's is that doing and how's that distorting the economy? And I think one of the things that's throwing people off is we're focused on the people that are getting hurt, and they're getting hurt massively. So I'm not downplaying the injured from the policies that are going on around the world. But you have massive spending going on that is driving the economy, that's distorting the views of who's getting hurt versus how's the world doing. So the economy is doing pretty well. The inequalities of the economy are probably even getting greater than they've been. And you're seeing that in the markets as well. Three companies accounted for 50% of the returns in the U.S. in the first half of the year. So I think this is something we have to kind of step back and think about a little differently, less emotionally and more realistically about how we play that, and how we think about the distortions that are going on, the who's getting hurt and who's getting helped, and how it impacts their actual numbers that are coming out, because the economic numbers for the U.S. are actually pretty good. We have low, record low unemployment. We have massive GDP growth is continuing at a good level. We do have debt and deficits that are rising, but those are down-the-road problems. And in the near term, there is a lot of stimulus in the system still, including a 1% cut in Fed funds rate that occurred last year that we seem to forget about. But that takes about 12 to 18 months to kick in, which is part of the reason why the economy has been as resilient as it's been. The other thing is we have to work through the trust in governments and media, because we can't trust what they're telling us. And that makes it hard to commit capital. But I think you're starting to see uncertainty come down. I haven't shown the policy index chart in a while.
Yeah, I was going to say, you always show that.
It's come down quite a bit. I'll show it next week, but it is real. It's easing. And I think every time we get a tariff deal done.
But meanwhile, Trump's approval ratings are still down. Are they bumped?
No, not yet. And that'll take a little bit of time because people are skeptical on the deals. And who's getting helped by those deals yet is a little bit unclear. What I would say is we are seeing capital flows in. It's not just the numbers I showed. It's, you know, when you think about $1.8 trillion roughly came in the last 12 months, June to June, with all the problems that we have. With the deals that are being cut, even if it's just previously agreed to capital, it's still capital flows that are coming in here that are coming away from other people that are going to help the U.S. and hurt others. So I think that's really it's a very complex and not as simple as everyone likes to make it on the news headlines and all that. And I think this is one of the problems that the media cycles we're in now and the TikTok kind of world we're in. There's no easy answers for a really complex economy that's getting more complicated by the minute. So I would just say dig a little deeper, look at data trends rather than data points, and don't overreact to the issues, because it's too easy to get sucked into either the politics, the emotions, or the negativity that's pervading right now.
Yeah, really, really interesting points. Going backwards really quickly to treasuries. Something that we hear a lot in the digital asset world is that stable coins will actually drive meaningful treasury demand, or they already have. So I think it's something like $200 billion of treasuries that are held via these stable coin companies. I'm curious, did you see anything like that in the data? Was it a meaningful, did you see any meaningful data points there?
I haven't seen any meaningful data points. I think it's too new. I think that's a view that will help. The other view that will help is that the deregulation is easing up the capital requirements for banks that'll let them hold more treasuries or report treasuries as held differently, that allow them to actually carry more treasuries on their books. That'll also ease some of that pressure. But I think in the end, I think people are overreacting to the view that the U.S. is done and that the age of U.S. exceptionalism is over. That was an easy view because of the, you know, the 145% tariffs with the U.S. and China and all that, and the 50% tariffs. But when you're down to 16% tariffs, I think some companies will be able to deal with that well. You'll see one of the things that's going to come out of this, I think will be a big surprise, is how many companies get wiped out in this process, because at 14% tariff increase, that wipes out their profit margins. So
got it.
I think don't overreact to the Bitcoin, but I think it'll help.
Adam, your hands up.
Good morning, everyone. Stephen, excellent presentation by the numbers. Really appreciate it. My question is, are we seeing yet those tariffs coming into the system and impacting inflation? I mean, we're going from a tariff of what was average 3% to 16%. When will we start to see that impact the economy?
That's a great question. I think this is the other thing that we have to be careful about is we haven't seen inflation yet, so it's not coming from tariffs. And I think you have to be really careful with that because of the pull forward of demand of companies trying to eat it so they don't have to make price adjustments until they absolutely have to, when they're sure what their exposure is. I think those are the issues that you're seeing. So I don't think it's come through yet. I think Goldman, I think, came out with a study that said basically that the exporters are eating 20%. The businesses will eat about 40% and the consumers will pay about 40% of the tariffs. So if you think about it in those terms, it hasn't come through yet. I think that it will be coming through. And I think this is part of the disconnect between the Fed and the administration is the administration has an easy way to lower the net interest costs if we bring down the short rates. So they think we can save $1 trillion that way, and that's the goal there. I think that's accurate in saying that. I think what you would have on the other side is inflation picking up. So I think you haven't seen it yet. I think you have to be careful with that. I do think it will be coming through in the numbers in the next quarter, couple of quarters.
As a follow-up, Stephen, when you say you think it'll be coming up in the next quarter, follow-up quarters, is that through the holiday seasons and the buying season as the retailers go through their inventory that they've bought?
I think it's more, Adam, just people understanding as we get to final tariff agreements with countries, you know what your number is, and then you can see how you have to, what your pricing can be around that. I think you also have to see, companies are also waiting to see what the implications of tariffs on one country are mean for another. So the U.S. automakers are struggling with the Japan having 15% tariffs when parts coming through Canada and Mexico are at 25% tariffs. So this is part of what's slowing down the price changes and the inflation changes because this is how complicated it gets. I wish Matthew Friedman was on.
I spent an hour with him yesterday.
Thank you, Stephen.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. Michael, then Bill, and Jonathan.
Stephen, everybody's talking about the 15% tariffs on Japan, on the EU, but I'm not hearing people talk about the fact that we're still seeing high tariffs on specific commodities like steel or copper. And so it creates a kind of strange situation. Autos coming in from Europe or Japan at 15%, but steel coming in at 50%. That kind of hurts U.S. auto manufacturers.
Consistency in policy is not always the top of the list, right? There's no way to explain that, Michael, other than this is what they have to work through to figure it out, and goes back to the last question. Mark, you just experienced this with Matt Friedman there. I wouldn't want to be in his seat right now trying to sort through how you price your business out when you're getting parts sourced from Canada and Mexico.
They can't wait for consistency.
Yeah.
Bill?
Yeah. As always, great stuff. And thanks for the clarity on the numbers. I just want to underscore your point on the China holdings because total U.S. government debt outstanding is $28 trillion. So the $800 billion that China is holding is only 3% of total outstanding. So it's definitely come down, you know, quite a bit. And I think also that if China wanted to liquidate that in a way, they would be hurting themselves because you're still a significant enough part of the marketplace that you'd probably be affecting prices. So that's that one. Also, it was interesting on the tariff question and kind of, Adam, it kind of goes to your question a little bit. There was an estimated surplus, budget surplus for June of about $26 billion. And there is, in, if you look at the fine print, there could be some shifts that maybe it was a surplus, maybe it was just less of a deficit at the end of the day. But customs duties rose by $18 billion, or almost 300% during that month. So the tariffs are having an impact, you know, on the budget situation. So we'll see whether or not that continues on. And I think, Stephen, your point on, are we going to see further increases in tariffs, which if you see that, then you will have an impact on inflation. Otherwise, it's kind of a one-time effect, and it'll just keep going. So just a couple of things there.
I just want to add one thing on tariffs. There is some court cases on tariffs coming up that may force Trump to change how he's approaching tariffs. But he has the ability to do he can't do across-the-board tariffs easily. That's part of what the Supreme Court went against him on. But he can do sectoral and industry tariffs, and I would expect you'll see more of them, one-off tariffs like he's doing on steel. And that actually does screw up how companies can plan their spending, and it does mess with the inflationary numbers as well. Let's keep it going. Jonathan.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Stephen, as always. Question regarding sort of competing inflationary versus interest rates. How do you see this working out? You've got tariffs hitting major sectors for construction, yet we're hearing that the Fed might be lowering rates, and so that should help construction. How do you see this thing playing out over the next 12 months?
I think the issues that would push the economy forward where lowering rates would help is really in housing, starts with housing, and that's the long end coming down, and I just don't see the long end coming down. So I saw a number for housing that you'd have to have the 10-year drop 285 basis points or house prices to drop something like 27% for housing affordability to match where income wage growth has gone. So that's really the problem, and that's not going to get resolved anytime soon. So that way. So I don't think that bring down short rates will do what the administration would want anyway. So I'm just not in the camp that that's the right answer.
Right now we're kind of stuck is what literally right now we're kind of stuck. It doesn't sound like we're going to get unstuck anytime soon.
No, I'm actually in the camp that the Fed should either not cut or only do one cut, if at all, this year. So I think we're really closer where neutral rates should be. It's just going to be painful until you get through some of the process.
Okay. So, thank you.
Welcome.
Lubna and Chaz. Or Chaz. There she is. Okay.
Go first. Let me go first. It's okay because I took a long time.
Go ahead, Lubna.
Okay. So, I'm a fan of scenario planning, I have to say, and I'm just wondering, as you were speaking, how do we be, other than that, to be anticipatory rather than, and responsive rather than reactive and unprepared, especially if we're talking about following trends when nothing about what's happening today is precedented and not this administration's views on human rights and climate leaves us looking like we're bipolar or something as a country. And I wonder if how are we taking that into account when we're can we redirect the future through our investments? Rather than follow the misguided things.
I think this is where I struggle on these calls because when I'm describing the economic environment and the backdrop and the policies, I'm really focusing on it from its impact on the economy. And you're bringing up social issues that are real and will impact the economy and require getting the right attention. I think that's really where the philanthropy part of Mark's group comes into play. I think as I think about your question, Lubna, I think I look at it as are the policies helping the majority the most? And what is really interesting about your question, for all the talk about all the people that are being damaged, if you step back, what's gone on in the last 20 years has brought almost 3 billion people out of poverty around the world. So we have to balance off things are improving with things are getting worse with the discussion. So I'm not sure the better way to answer that for you than they're real issues. They will impact us over the long term. How do you navigate this? For me, as I separate the social from the economic and political and really focus on what I'm trying to do from an investment perspective as opposed to from a philanthropic one.
Right. And I'm fully with you. And I don't think philanthropic is not charitable. Philanthropic, to be sustainable, has to be generative. But we can't ignore. So what I'm not saying to be driven by it, I'm saying that we have an opportunity to actually steer away from it by creating use cases that are profitable, that are viable, that are creating meaningful impact. That's all I'm saying. But
I agree. And I think you're going to, with AI, which I can't believe we've gone this far without using the word AI.
I was just bringing it back home. Thank you for bringing it home for me, Mark.
Well, okay? That's sort of what we're going to talk about, because I think that the power of this group and family offices in general to use it in the, you know, for good or for philanthropy purposes is huge. So we become laser focused on who can do what to help what and whom and all the rest. So that's definitely part of it. Chad, though, first.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you, Stephen, for an excellent quantitative presentation today. Lots of very interesting data. I'm looking at the 10-year. Stephen, and I'm here in Atlanta, and I'm looking at the kind of compression we're seeing in the real estate market and what is arguably one of the fastest growing metros in the country and probably one of the strongest, most diversified economies statewide in the country. But it's feeling pain here in real estate, and that's very, very real. Not just on the commercial side, but particularly for the initial home buyer. It's a tough equation right now.
Yep.
So my question goes to the 10-year, which I think has the greatest influence on mortgage rates. Which, of course, I think we'd all like to see mortgage rates come down. So can you spin up a scenario based on the tools that the administration has at its hands, based on the dynamics facing our friends at the Fed? What are the plausible scenarios that could cause us to see some reduction in the 10-year by the end of this year? Maybe it's going to take longer. Hopefully not. That's my question.
All right, let me ask you a question. What's the average 30-year fixed rate mortgage back to this 71 or 1970?
1970?
Yeah.
Oh, I wasn't even born then. No, I'm just kidding.
I'll give you the number.
I'm going to say that was high. That was probably low double digits.
It was the average for that period from 71 forward is 7.71%.
Okay.
It was all over the place during that period.
That was before Carter. Okay.
Yeah. But I guess my point is that housing affordability is a real issue in the U.S. right now. It's a real issue in many places around the world. I don't think you can manipulate rates down to solve that problem. I think this is a problem that will work out over a multi-year period. I think that we have we got away from the kind of the post-World War II period appropriate housing, where you didn't have McMansions, you had homes that served for more utilitarian purposes, as opposed to the McMansions. We got away from affordable housing to zero interest rates over the last 15 years didn't help affordability either. And then if you go back to the great financial crisis, one of the causes of that was Congress thought everyone should have a home. And prior to that, that wasn't, you know, it was the American dream, but it wasn't the American requirement that everyone had a home. A lot of people rented and did fine. So I think we have, I don't think there's an easy answer to your question, Chess. It's the reality. I think it's going to be a long, slow grind in housing.
Thank you, Stephen.
And as Samir highlighted, we gotta change the script for our younger people, because I think young people around the world are losing hope for what their future is. And I think that's a key thing that we have to flip this script on and get them into the right jobs, right education, things like that. And college isn't for everyone and all that. We have to really rethink trades and the whole thing. So it's a very complicated issue. So don't expect improvement in the rates situation considerably by the end of the year. Tim, we're going to have to move to the next session soon. So I have these two questions quickly.
Okay, so what is the magnitude of a Fed cut it's looking for? I mean, do they think in terms of like 25 basis points, 50 basis points, 75? If you're going to cut, you need to do at least 50 basis points. Just a little bit about the thought process around what they are wrestling with.
To what, though, is the point? I think the view has generally been to bail the economy out of a recession, the Fed needs 4% rate cuts. I think the president thinks that if you get Fed funds down to one, it'd be easy to get money flowing in the system again. It would bring the 10-year down and everything would move again. I'm just not sure you would get the housing where it needs to be for that. So I think that's the issues, Tim. It's really not an easy setup for them. So I don't think the Fed would have to move in multiple cuts to create a move. And I think the Fed's worry is that would be inflationary, not deflationary.
Thank you.
And nothing on fiscal policy that the Trump administration could, no levers they have in their control, you think?
Deregulation helps ease some of the pressures, may help businesses start up. But you need wage growth to be moving a little bit higher too. And that's tough in this environment with AI. You are seeing average wages increasing, but that's because some companies will be on layoffs. Michael?
So this goes back to what Mark said, two things he said a little bit earlier. First, he mentioned AI, and then he mentioned power. And one of the interesting things I've just been reading about is the construction of power plants not tied to the grid. There was just an announcement of a facility, $1.7 billion, with two gas-fired plants in the facility, and it's supporting data centers. It is not connected to the grid. So I think this takes us into interesting territory, because it changes the dynamics for traditional power providers and also the organizations that manage the load across the grid. So any thoughts on that, Stephen?
I think you're into how you invest in this environment. Michael is focused on the areas of required spending if you want to get a good night's sleep. So you go after how we solve the electrification issue, how we incorporate digitalization into everything we do, getting AI to make us more productive, how you lower healthcare costs, those are a couple of the key issues. National security is the other one, and how you deal with the reindustrialization. They're pretty much all interconnected. So to me, that's how you navigate what's a very unclear environment, is go to the areas of required spending.
The data center's usage of power was a dramatic shift. Utilities were not expecting about 8 years ago. Everyone from Blackstone, which owns bought out pretty much all the available data center, you know, builders, they have power leased up for 7 years in advance. Some people have to set some certain geographies have a 7-year waiting list for power. So you're totally right, and that's why Three Mile Island's come back online and some of the other ones, and that's all why it's actually helped some tertiary areas that actually had surplus power are getting businesses and data centers there because they actually have the power to spare and they can't afford other places. Like New York City is actually they're building a power plant now, finally, upstate because they realize that closing Indian Point, we're short power, and the Einsteins want to cut a couple of our peaking plants out in Brooklyn and Queens, which would just cost the city billions. So a lot of municipalities are dealing with this and trying to find ways around it. And the utility, you know, and power hedge funds are very on top of this, and they know where the bottlenecks are. And there's a lot of opportunity, but you have to find the right edge to play it, because someone says they're starting a data center, that's great, but the question is, do they have the power supply, the political capital, and the customers locked up to afford that whole structure? So it's trickier than it seems, but that tide is lifting boats across energy, infrastructure, industrials across the board.
But also it's the sellers and buyers of power are both looking for long-term stability, not just of supply, but of price, because there's too much variability and either end gets into trouble or, you know, when things move. So
that's a bigger problem in other areas of the world too. Other countries, that's part of what's a big problem for Germany right now is the inconsistency of power availability and price. Mm-hmm.
You know, LNG is helping, but it's not the cure-all.
I meant to Michael's point about being off-grid and having these deals.
So, Tim, is it a
good one? Just a comment, and maybe I've been out of the industry for too long, but, you know, maybe it wasn't all that long ago. Maybe it was longer than I thought, but a lot of industrial facilities used to have their own power plants and relied on the utilities for backup. So it sounds to me like, you know, these facilities building their own private power sources is, you know, kind of like what's old is new again or something like that. So.
Exactly. I don't know why people ask these questions and they don't reach out to me. The key is to own your own microgrid and use the grid as a backup. That's it. If you own your own power, you control your own destiny.
And is the best place to do that, Giovanni, Tulsa?
All right.
Not necessarily. Tulsa is a has-been power center, but at least there's a lot of intellectual capital there, know-how, and so on and so forth. But Tulsa itself is not a center of power.
Okay, we're gonna switch over in Newport. If you haven't seen the digest, you like just look at these pictures, right? And I'll, for our benefit, I partly just saw you. Sorry, everyone. Thanks. Well, yeah, there we go. So, by the way, thank you everyone for a great conference. Those who participated, there's a lot of follow-up. We sort of softly debuted what we're doing with Yasmin and her team, which we'll talk about on AI. Some of the panels were AI. We just can't. It is what it is. It permeates. And we are finally, you know, spending 5 hours in a car back and forth from New York with Yasmin and seeing how she uses AI and how we're about to use AI. We should be using AI. Was eye-opening. So, again, you can look at what we just did in Newport, but what came out of it is what you all soon will see is how we should be interacting in a whole new way. What I wanted to do is sort of frame this a little bit, how we're making some transitions, and I think these are long overdue transitions for 361 firm. And before I pass it off to Yasmin, and you can probably take over the screen, I'll stop sharing, but I wanted to, you know, we've been building 361 firm for, you could say, decades in some ways, but since 2016, I was doing alumni networking for my college, later my law school. It was my passion project, right? I'm looking at Rich Sobel. Harvard had a building. They have the most amazing global network. And I was like that car company, Hertz, you know, you got to try harder. So we tried harder and we got together at 360. We got together in circles and round tables and we punched harder. We got 300 people from Denison University. And then I used that same playbook with Michigan and I took it to the family office world. But what we've never had, and we've done these events in 22 countries, we have 1,500 videos. I was just looking. 800 or 700 podcasts. We've created so much content together, but we do not use technology very well. It's 2025. So sort of going from the expression outhouse to the White House, like we're now able to leapfrog. So we do have trust. We do have genuine relationships. We've got great people. Now what people want to do is cut through the noise, right? And last thing you need is one more WhatsApp group. But I might create one, but I'm trying to not create them anymore, right? Trying to cut through. And we want to also have people have been able to contribute. So what you're about to see is we're about to transition to a digital platform. It's called 361firm.digital. It's live. Everything behind it's live. We're going to put up a little paywall. We want to make it accessible, but just want to make sure it's sort of like anting up at the table, $361 a year. We call it basic. This is the part that it should be a no-brainer. If it's not a no-brainer, you probably don't belong here. Full stop. Right? Now we have premium features and, you know, we call it pro and we will have things for qualified purchasers. But, what I've been doing is, I think we've been fertilizing the soil. I think a lot of things we can grow together to, even something someone said earlier, what we can do for philanthropy. But let's just level set and let's all use AI together. So we started thanks to Dipinder. Where Dipinder on here? Mm-hmm. Dipinder's introduced me to a lot of people, and maybe you, all of you. So the human to human is always going to be important. So Dipinder introduced me to Yasmin 15 months ago, and since then we developed a vendor relationship, then a friendship, and now a partnership. And now what we're doing is joining forces. To offer something, and I think you should all be excited about it. Hopefully, you will. And if you're not, you're not. But if you are, this train is about to go in some new directions. And I think that'll be helpful not only if you are a thought leader and you want to join boards, or if you're an investor trying to find the deals, or you're an investor trying to help raise money for your fund or your deals. We're about to have AI agents galore. And we're going to give you also AI agents, but we're going to help you collaborate with our fellow humans. So with that, can I hand over to you? Yes?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, it's great to see you all. So I recognize already some people we met in Newport. Thank you, Mark, for this introduction. I think one of the benefits we want to build together is how we build value together apart from events. So obviously events are very important. It's the human factor. And I think that it was evident when we were in Newport, that beautiful villa in front of the ocean, and people were actually talking about deal making. What we want to do is to create this kind of connection also in between events and to give each member 361 this value that is accessible 24/7. Now, many of you probably already thinking or strategizing about the AI strategy on in creating investment memos or how to make decisions, how to consult. So one of the most exciting thing that for me was absolutely fascinating in joining forces with Mark is how we can create collective intelligence. And that collective intelligence can create a better AI agent. Just to give you an idea, this conversation we had, a lot of knowledge has been shared. But what do we do with that knowledge? There are a lot of conversations across the years. How can we actually leverage this conversation to each one of you to make better decisions, to have a certain memory, or even just to get access to insights of someone else's opinion? And this is what we're building. And I think that this is an exciting moment for AI entrepreneurs and AI investors, because you always need to think, what's your edge? What is your proprietary data that you are creating? And all of us here now creating together proprietary data. And maybe I can show just quickly the website. So I also copy-pasted in the chat if you're interested and curious. And I'm going to be very, very brief in the presentation, Mark, because I think that we can have, we already scheduled one-on-one meetings, and I think that we can talk a bit further. And I also want to kind of leave time for questions. So I'm going to just show 60 seconds, two minutes, the new website that is launched. What can you expect from it? And the second thing is to show how we already started to populate conversations and what's the benefit for you, because let's face it, you're all very busy and we need clear value. So let me present it and then we open it up to questions to keep things more dynamic and interesting. So let me share my screen. Okay. Can you see my screen? Yeah.
I see
perfect. You. So if you just type 361theorem.digital, you will have access to this new website. We just launched it today. And you can already see that it has a bit of kind of a look and feel, which is different. So you see here what we have been built and the legacy of Mark and you, all of you together as a collective, main benefits that you get. And of course, we're going to add here the AI aspect that is absolutely new, that every member of 361 will get built in. This is from the digest, right? So I really encourage you to check what other people say. The focus is as well how we bring AI into the family office world. So I think that they're a very interesting perspective. You feel free to explore the AI and the about. So this is an only members will have access to the digital platform. So this is live. Please check. And I want to show you the digital platform. So every user, every member of 361 will have its own personalized dashboard and access to only relevant deals. It could be deals. It can be as well content generated. So you have here on the right your personalized AI assistant. By the way, we also showed how you can converse. I won't show it now, but this is one exciting option.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. Everything is going to be conversational, literally. You don't need to type.
Exactly. So, for example, if I'm interested, now we're already showing you what's relevant for you because we integrate with your LinkedIn and your bio and the diagnostic. So we kind of want to get to know you better. But what you see here is that I ask the agent, please give me only real estate deals. And it gives you here only access to relevant deals. Already imagine all the noise that you have, all the deals that you're probably reviewing. We want cuts to the noise. I want to show you decision room that is focused on the briefings, and you all going to have access to this. If you would like to utilize it, this is really up to you. But what you see here is a memory and governance of all the conversations we had. So, for example, if we are going to Tuesday briefing.
I created that. Then I started to create one for each briefing.
Okay. So what you see here is that we have here data source, which means that we upload your transcript of the meeting. And what we're doing, we start to use generative AI to summarize this meeting, to also surface different perspectives, surface risks, benefits, and different voices. So you see here Ken Goldman, Michael Hammer. We have a lot of insights from Stephen, obviously. So we don't want you to, if you miss the conversation, doesn't mean that you need to miss the interaction or the knowledge. So we're going to do the same with everything that has been said today. So we are, the next step for us is to start to kind of collect that and create even stronger AI. So even if you're thinking about, oh, I want to check about technology, oil and gas deal, we also want to educate and to bring from the past relevant information that has been shared among members in this room. So I'm going to stop here. And Mark, if you like to kind of maybe summarize that and kind of have a clear call to action.
Me having clear calls to action?
Yeah.
Fine. No, I think what we are doing, that was a lot, was a great roadmap. To create what, beyond this, what we all want, think we all aspire to do here together, it does take more development. So charging this basic 360 watt a year fee is part of that. That's my call to action. But we are we will be engaging at a different level with QPs. So we're having probably 50 one-on-one meetings in the next 3-4 weeks, despite the vacation season. We'll be continuing to answer questions, but I think the best way to engage is to get on and join, and then you'll have your own nav. It'll be basic. You can't ping it 100 times a day like you maybe do with your ChatGPT, or you can pay up for that. So we're enabling you to do that, but we just wanted you to get on and engage. And the more of us that are on, obviously, it's more content, more proprietary data for all of us.
Yeah, I do want to add one more aspect, which is important, because many of those conversations, you all have a portfolio company or some assets you would like to find who else in my network is relevant. So this is as well one of the key elements that we are training the AI. So if you have an asset, you invested in a certain company, you want to see who else might be relevant experts or can help with business, value creation, co-investment. We are going to let any one of you to leverage the power of this network at scale. So I think this is a very important distinguishes us. You can't do it in OpenAI. You can't do it in Perplexity. You can't do it in Claude or whatever AI agency you're currently using. This is really leveraging the proprietary data, which is of 361 assets and people.
Maybe you could talk just for a second about your team that is behind you, because it's, you know, I know you have a lot of AIs, but you've got a great team that's now. We're working together.
Yes, of course. Thank you. I do want to give a shout out to my co-founder and head of AI, Javier Sanchez. He is based in Madrid. We are, apart from the fact that we both started from corporate venture capital together, and we were both suffering the same frustration of slow decision making. How do you make decision in a group? We decided to do something about it and become entrepreneurs. So Javi is doing his PhD in memory computing. He's in the AI business for 15 years. And he launched some recommendation system startups before. I'm an engineering cognitive psychologist.
I'm mindful of the time. I didn't see the time. We're 12
yeah.
already.
Yes.
But Javi, you need to. You'll be part of the next one for sure. But Samir, you had a quick question.
I do, which is fantastic platform. I just mean I look forward to engaging with it. I do have a concern, which is that there are cases where. What generative AI does is it takes, let's say, comments that people have made, and I've seen comments that I've made in the past, right, that were interpreted by generative AI and then summarized. Now, unfortunately, what can happen sometimes is that generative AI may give a different flavor of the comment. So specifically, the comment that was presented on the screen that you just shared was that I said that U.S. manufacturing assets are primarily being purchased by Chinese family offices. That's not exactly what I said. So the issue is that sometimes
here's the great thing. There's a citation. We go. You go directly to the source on everywhere on every page.
What I request is the ability to be able to edit those, right? So that in case AI creates a different impression or perception by the audience, right? That somebody said something when they didn't, when they maybe meant something slightly different. Does that make sense?
First of all, thanks for sharing this. And this is not hassle-free. So this is not a magic solution. And one of the things that's important is to get feedback from each one of you. So the answer is yes. We're going to allow you to also edit that to make sure you can do it already, by the way. The second thing is that we mentioned here interpretation. This is something we are not interested in doing. So we kind of want to surface the insights as they are, because we don't want to create here subjective elements and noise. So the interpretation here, this is not really correct. But again, there's a lot of fine tuning that is necessary.
Right. The issue here is that AI platforms, by their nature, right, do make some interpretation of real things that people said, right? And it can result in a different impression being formed by people based on an AI system that adds in some different words, perhaps, right? So yes, it's a machine doing it, which is great, but we should just have the ability, let's say, to edit, as Mark said, or to override that, to make sure that the incorrect perception about what we may have said or meant isn't created for a larger audience.
Of course.
Understood. And I remember that exact moment when you said it, because it made me think, wow, no one's buying manufacturing companies. But I'm sure it deserves a longer discussion. Adam?
Quick question, Mark. Using those, you have all of these events on YouTube. I'm assuming that those will still be available on YouTube.
Yeah. Yeah, but they're better digested and
understood. No, I understand that. Yeah.
Well,
that's it. What
you might start to see as we go forward, more like highlights on YouTube, and the full sessions in house.
You and me.
Okay. Right,
Andy.
To the point about interpretation, and I realize it's not trying to form an opinion, is there possible to introduce some training mechanism that when corrections are made or changes are made, that there is a comparison between the original and then the human edited result, and it learns from that and does a better job maybe? I don't know. This is a kind of an open question more than a specific one.
Yeah. It's a great idea.
It would be redlining. There's tech for that with legal docs for redlining. You guys highlight, see the changes in the flow of changes over time. So there's probably might be a way to incorporate that into it, but that's above my skill set. But
hey, for the, I mean, there's always going to be, it's never going to be perfect when you launch, right? And there's going to be a lot of learning. But the key I think we have an advantage of is that all of us as members will have input as to which direction we want to take this in. And for the record, I'll be signing up today for the 1 year thing because I think that's the best value as opposed to the 361 thing.
That's big of you, Defender.